For those of you that attended the opening ceremony, there were two things that caught my attention with two speakers. One was Dr. Hoyt and one was Dr. Collins, which essentially relate to the next scenario. We hear a lot now about burnout, frustration, whether it's young surgeons, older surgeons, senior surgeons, junior surgeons. It's a real issue. It's a truly real issue. And maybe it's been there for a long time and we haven't really bothered to notice it. It may have been seen as a sign of weakness in the past if you had some of these issues. And then Dr. Collins talked about the drug dependency problem in the United States and how unfortunately and sadly we as physicians have been largely responsible for it by giving prescription drugs to people after procedures without a lot of thought and foresight on the reaction of the human body to these drugs. So this scenario is real, and our college is trying to deal with it. You can go on the college website and see the programs and the way the college is trying to handle it, especially if you have colleagues that you think need some assistance. But this scenario, I think, is real. And so I'd like to ask our panel, maybe start with Dr. Malcolm. What do you think about this one, and how do you approach this, and what are the things to recognize first and foremost that allows you to be proactive in these cases?
Well, I think that the last line on this scenario involves suicidal tendencies. And certainly suicide is one of the manifestations of burnout, but that really changes the urgency and the requirement here to intervene quickly and to intervene well. And this is not a scenario that any of us are trained for, and by no means would I say that I'm any expert, having not dealt with this before. But one thing that comes up over and over and over again is that you have to make contact with a junior surgeon, with the other person. You have to make time in your schedule. This is never going to happen in a time where you are available to sit down. It will mean that you might have to cancel a case or dinner at home or something like that. But this is a partner of yours who at this point, their life really depends on my availability, my being there for them, my listening and helping them talk through this so that at least the urgency of the idea of suicide goes away. And I think if truly there are suicidal tendencies and we ask typical questions like, have you considered suicide? I think that the point is tackle it head on. Don't beat around the bush. Find out if they have a plan. Find out if they've had thoughts of suicide before and if they are using drugs or alcohol or anything like that. And if the answer to any of those things is yes, then it's a trip to the emergency room for both of you.
You know, there was an article this year in the Bulletin of the Royal College of Surgeons of England about this issue of burnout. And in a survey, an anonymous survey done of a sizable percentage of their fellows, 21% said they had had thoughts of committing suicide. Now, these may not be very obvious thoughts that they make known to people, but that was pretty frightening when I read that. So Dr. Rozicki, what have you in your department done anything about addressing this issue proactively? And what can you give the audience as some suggestions about dealing with proactive programs in their own hospital or in their own, you know, communities, et cetera?
I think the aspect of well-being or some sort of balance or safe culture really needs to be a core competence in each department. And when I say a core competence, I mean very seriously that decisions you make have to flow from those core competencies. And this is one of them, and sometimes those decisions are difficult to make. For example, It's not just appointing a person to oversee well-being, but maybe it means having a well-being seminar, and we do that in conjunction with another hospital. And so that means bringing in speakers or engaging just different methods of decompressing, for one thing. And then I think that when the residents, trainees, medical students, and everything see that it's important at the top, it's coming from the top, it's also coming from the bottom down, it does permeate, and it takes time to change a culture. And we baby boomers did not train during that period, and we were trained not to open our mouths, and we were trained not to complain. So it does take time to change that culture, but I do think we see value in it.
Dr. Schechter, tough guys, really top-notch, tough surgeons, they don't have to deal with this, right?
Well, one of the great regrets in my career was working with a chief resident, and we had a retroperitoneal, a retrocaval pheochromocytoma. The guy did a spectacular job of taking it out, and we had looked like the vena cava, like the Golden Gate Bridge over this chasm. And I looked up and I said, "You did a fabulous job." And he looked at me and he said, "You know, you're the first person that has complimented me in the entire residency program." And this guy went on to, and this guy was a great researcher. I mean, articles, you know, like as long as my arm in the best journals. And he went on to do a cardiothoracic residency program, and 1 week before he was supposed to start his first job, he OD'd and died. And I will always regret that I failed to recognize that this guy was drowning and didn't throw him a lifeline. And we who are teachers, we have to, I think the family concept that Jerry, that you spoke about is really true. We have to treat our trainees as members of our family, and I like what Jacob said about I always ask somebody who I think is having a difficulty, have you considered suicide? I regret that I did not ask that person the same question.
Yes, sir.
Oh, my name is Dave Chesley. I'm from Tampa, Florida, and I work at a place that has a really good physician development program. So every year that we have a med staff retreat, and they'll pick a topic of the year. And recently we did have a whole 2.5 days, I think, on physician burnout, and kind of getting to what Dr. Rozicki and what Dr. Schechter said. This was touched on at the weekend that we had at our retreat, but the idea of loss of control being a major source of people feeling burned out, and it seems like everybody recognizes that, but it doesn't seem like anything can be done about it. And it seems like your only recourse is to just accept it and not let that bother you. Every time we turn around, it seems like we are ceding control to something else. I just came from a really good talk by Dr. Gawande about systematizing things, whether it's conversations or checklists or one thing or another, where your individual authority is being kind of assumed by the bigger pieces of the machine. I don't know how people can feel less, or I don't know how people can feel more in control under those kind of conditions. I don't know how to avoid burnout when that's the cause of it.
Well, maybe it's going to be in your generation's purview to take back control of these things. Because I suspect my generation...
I'm 52.
Well, you're a lot younger than I am. And what I was going to say is I think my generation has dropped the ball in these respects, because I think we've allowed a lot of other people out there to set the agenda, whether it's for training. We as surgeons stood by and just took for granted that 80 hours was the right time for a surgeon to train, without any real study, without any real data, et cetera. We just walked to the end of the pier and jumped in the water. And we're doing the same with the way our hospitals are run and treadmills being turned up and so forth. So I think it behooves us to step back and think about what this 52-year-old surgeon just said to us about what's going on here and where did this all happen and how do we try to turn this Titanic around before it's really too late, because it is leading to this issue and I think this is real. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, Dana Thompson. Thank you, Jerry.
Oh, hi, Dana.
I'm a 51-year-old surgeon and I'm a survivor of burnout. And one of the things that I really believe is this new reorganization of the dyad of administrators and physicians being partnered. I think that's really the only way we're going to take this back. And I'll use an example in our pediatric otolaryngology practice. We have a Spanish-speaking population of well over 60% in some of our clinics and didn't have appropriate interpreting services. That is a trigger for burnout and throughput. Mm-hmm. And what we ended up doing is engaging our team in the systems-based process improvement and showing a model where we got our MAs, Spanish interpreting, credentialing, joy in practice for the MAs. They're more engaged, we're more engaged, and we made a substantial ROI on those. So I'm just encouraging people to get really involved in the systems-based solutions that are the triggers of our behavior.
Thank you, Dana. Yes, ma'am.
Tracy Aravine from the UK. I have dealt with a young trainee with serious self-harm issues, and my hospital has also dealt with a young trainee with drug dependence issues. And like we heard about the surgeon with bipolar, these things would not have been a surprise. And the trainee with the drug dependence issues, it was known about through the program, but the information wasn't allowed to be passed on as they rotated through the program for their confidentiality. But it meant that we couldn't have developed systems to keep things under control. And for my trainee with the self-harm, I couldn't pass her story on to her next hospital so that they could watch out for the triggers that had resulted in her self-harm. What can we do to provide support systems for vulnerable individuals while still maintaining this confidentiality?
Dr. Crowder, you want to deal with that?
I think this is important. I just come back from a state meeting. I think the statistics were last year was 387 physicians in the United States committed suicide. It's a big number, and I was amazed. The one thing is, he made the point where this is an alarm. This is an immediate alarm. The days of not doing anything and then regretting it is long gone. Lucky enough, in my state, we have an excellent PHP physician help program so that we could call at any time and have professional. This is more than just you and I talking to each other and asking if you have a problem. If this is documented that there's drug dependency and suicidal tendencies, then we have to get really professional help. And very salvageable, you know. When you lose a surgeon in a town, it's devastating. It's devastating. So I think that this is, if the red flags are going up, then you have to be very, very proactive and say, hey, listen, we see there's a problem here. How can we help? And ask those questions and then get them in, if you have to bring them yourself, professional help.
Doctor, could you go back to the microphone, please? So are you prevented in the UK from reporting on the chain due to government regulation, bureaucracy, government rules? Is that what restrains you?
Our trainees rotate from hospital to hospital.
Yes.
And so the training program controls the information that we're allowed to pass through from hospital to hospital. And so for their confidentiality, I wanted to obviously let the new team know that she was vulnerable and the things I felt were contributory, and we couldn't do that.
So could you report back to the training program, and could then they report
it? I did report back to the training program.
Okay. So they could report it to the next hospital.
But they could, but when the trainee came to us with the drug issues, it was not passed on to us.
Yeah. Well, this is a problem not just in the UK. I think confidentiality rules are real, in this country, and you know, it's the old story of the legislation and the laws not keeping in tune with reality, which we see as physicians. So, Dr. Schechter, you know, how are we going to deal with that?
When I heard your story, it reminded me in the 1980s in California, if a person was HIV positive, we were forbidden, but de jure, from writing that information in the chart. And of course, that is just totally and completely wrong, and we changed the law. So it seems, so if a person is using drugs, to me that is both a healthcare issue for the person who's doing it, but it's also a patient safety issue. So that rule or law, whatever it is just wrong. And if a person is harming themselves and is at risk for suicide, well, we don't want to have happen to that person what happened to my resident. And so, to me, you know, those rules or laws have to be changed. And I think a reasonable person having a discussion at a meeting like this would come to the conclusion that they are wrong and would agree to change them.
Dr. Moreland, you've done some work with the YFA and have some information that the college has put together on some of these issues. Did you want to speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, but I also wanted to respond directly to the question that was just asked. Because it's very interesting, because here many of the studies that have looked at reasons why physicians and residents who are suffering from burnout do not seek help, one of the most commonly cited reasons is their lack of confidence in the confidentiality mechanism, their fear for being exposed, their fear for being earmarked as someone with this kind of a problem. And therefore they go on and self-medicate and self-treat, and the spiral continues. So it's a very interesting aspect of the confidentiality issue that it actually works against this particular individual in both ways.
I think that scenario you mentioned, though, ma'am, has two aspects to it. The drug dependency, at least in this country, and I forget the body in the UK that controls licensure, but in this country, the licensure of physicians is controlled on an individual state-by-state basis. And most states, if you as a physician are aware of another physician using drugs and treating patients, that's a serious patient safety offense, and both you and the user can be suspended. So I think that's a little different than the mental health issue where there's a suicide tendency. The first one really is impacting patients as a broad spectrum. The second is impacting that particular doctor as a potential patient. So it's a kind of a touchy, tricky situation. Yes?
Yeah, Megan Tracy from Charlottesville. I wanted to flag the drug use issue as well. I think the issue of the impaired physician is an important one, and I think suicidal tendencies were flagged as the urgent issue there. The impaired physician is incredibly important, and I would note that most organizations have pretty clear policy, medical staff policies with regard to impaired physicians, and from the physician's perspective, most states have fairly robust policies around proactively seeking therapy for a problem. So if you can get to that physician very quickly, mm-hmm. and you can essentially, in most medical staffs, require that they undergo an evaluation and that they seek help, they can be treated in a supportive way. If they're reported, if this is allowed just to go on, they don't have that available to them the same way, and the consequences are going to be incredibly serious for their careers. So I'd say the impaired physician is an emergent situation too. So it's a comment. My question with regard to burnout is that I've heard a lot about programs, wellness programs, and burnout programs that help people build resilience and are around meditation and reflection and building personal strength, but I haven't heard a lot about effective departmental, divisional, organizational responses in terms of changing somebody's actual immediate work environment to address burnout, overwork, whatever. Do any of you have experience with that or recommendations in that regard?
Dr. Rozicki?
a great question. I think the programs are out there, and I think you're right. They seem to be a little more isolated. It's not necessarily brought into the culture so that it is accepted across the board. It's almost as if you have a seminar to go to or a lecture of some sort, and then, well, we're back at business as usual, and the stress really never goes away.
It seems challenging to task the burned out person with taking ownership of fixing their burnout.
Right.
Yeah.
Bingo.
Yeah.
You know, the other place that's very interesting to start working, if you happen to be in an academic setting and are associated with a medical school, talk to your first year medical students. It's a fascinating discussion. They can tell you in the first year who are the people that A, are going to have either potential serious drug dependency, alcoholism, abusive behavior tendencies, and they want to get involved, and many medical schools are now beginning to address this issue. So I think the sooner we can tag these people with assistance in their medical careers, not when they're, you know, senior residents and not when they're staff surgeons, but really when in their first year of medical school, medical schools need to deal with this. They need to seek these people out, have programs, be proactive. And it's fascinating. We did a little thing with the Harvard medical students. I also did a similar thing with Cornell Medical School. And the students would tell you in the first year, they can tell who the people are in their class who have potential issues, and they tell you it usually is seen in social settings such as parties, where abusive behavior associated with heavy drinking occurs, and they can tag who these people are that need help. So it's a source that you might consider if you're associated with an academic setting. Yes, sir.
I'll just comment to the last person, the microphone, and just speaking on burnout a lot. We're in the phase of awareness, and so when I come in and speak as a guest in places, it's very challenging for me to get them to have expenditures that actually demonstrate that you're trying to do something about it. So one of the problems with raising awareness and then doing nothing about it actually exacerbates the problem.
Yeah.
But we got to start somewhere, so awareness is very important. I would just, you know, as again, given another perspective from the aspect of the impaired physician, one of the things to think about is that a surgeon who is sleep deprived, a surgeon who's going through a divorce, and a surgeon who has no drug or alcohol issues is potentially just as impaired doing surgery as somebody who's on drugs or intoxicated, or partially intoxicated. So if we sort of raise the issue of potential impairment and knowing that people recover from sleep deprivation, they recover from personal issues and can be incredibly effective surgeons, these surgeons also have the potential to recover and be very effective surgeons.
Okay, to wrap this up, because I know the hour is getting late and people are getting hungry and so forth, I'm going to ask Jacob to fill us in on some of the programs from the college standpoint and perhaps some references. So just tell me how you want to move the slides.
Sure. So just to point out for everyone, because, I mean, there are people who are in great need of this, and I think that we, as their colleagues, really need to also be trained in terms of how to address a colleague who needs our help. If you go to the college's website, under the first tab on the left is member services, and there's a drop-down menu that appears, and well-being is one of the first tabs there. You click on it, this is what the page looks like. And if you move forward on there, there are a number of very, very valuable resources. The first is a well-being index, which you need to get a sign-on for, but is an entirely free system. It's totally confidential. But it allows you or any other member of the college to measure their own well-being and track it over time. It also gets indexed across to results from surgeons nationwide, and this is a very, very valuable tool to help us in the diagnosis. Also on that page, this is just, you know, one screenshot of the numerous resources that are available, which are designed either to help individuals who are suffering from burnout and depression, or to help colleagues help individuals who are suffering from these things. And so the college resources in this area are actually very, very rich, very robust, and I'm afraid to say underutilized.
And these are some references that Jacob has kindly put together for us. I see, Jacob, you've actually written something yourself about
burnout. Yeah, I didn't put this together, but someone did.
Oh, okay. Well, you're in there.
Thanks.
So unless there are any other questions, I want to thank the panel. And Dr. Hanks, do you want to wrap this up for us? And
sure.
Thank you all for the opportunity to share these ideas. And I think hopefully we all leave here with some new energy to try to address some of these problems. Thank you.
Just very quickly, I believe there's a handout up front that our staff people have if somebody just wants to grab some hard copies. I would like to thank the panel very much. I would like to thank the audience for their participation and for sitting through, I'm sure, a little hypoglycemia as you're ready for dinner. Thank you all very much.